This is part two of my interview with Sean Blanchfield at Pagefair. In part one, we discuss Sean's background, Pagefair, the ad industry, ad blocking, and its popularity. In this part, we discuss some of the technical issues around ad blocking, how Pagefair works and its architecture, along with Sean's book choices and the importance of good relationships with customers. If I've installed an ad blocker in Firefox or Chrome, how does it actually block the ads?
Yeah, well, it's kind of like a firewall, right, between you and the ad server. There's two phases it applies. It's actually not too difficult to make an ad blocker. You could look at the source code for any of them, and it's not big or complicated. The first step is that it has a block list called EasyList that it downloads at regular frequencies. And this basically contains a long list of domain names of ad servers. It's actually more like a regex for any URL, right? It's got a bit of a weird syntax, but basically it's got pretty much all the ad servers in there. And any request going out from the browser to anything that matches that is just going to be intercepted and blocked by AdBlock. So that's the main technique it uses. It cuts off the communication before it starts. It's interesting that it does it that way, by the way, because that means that the call from the browser out to the ad server to get the ad never happens in the first place. So it's not like an ad was bought and paid for and never seen. It's like the opportunity to put an ad there disappeared, which means that it's the publisher that actually gets hurt, not the advertiser, which isn't what most users are intending, right? So the advertisers, by and large, in the industry don't even realize that ad blocking is big or happening because they can't see it. The servers they would use to look at the problem with are blocked, so they can't even see the users in the first place. And it's the publishers who are seeing it, and it's the publishers who are being put out of business, not the advertisers. So that's a bit of a shame. But anyway, that's technologically the first thing that happens. It blocks the communication. And then there's a second phase where it applies a large CSS override, right, a large style sheet over everything. And it goes through and tries to clean up any blank spaces or formatting issues that would have been created by basically blocking that communication. And it's very effective, right? If you use AdBlock, you tend to not even know that you're using it because it works so well. And sometimes you can just look at someone's face who has used AdBlock for a while they use the internet on someone else's computer and look at their jaw drop when they realize, wow, is this what the web's like today?
Yeah, I've felt that when I've switched to Internet Explorer for testing. It's just everywhere because, as you're saying, I didn't realize there was a CSS override. But I know that, the banner isn't just missing. It's gone. The content has been pushed up. The header has been brought down.
Yeah. So it claps things like anything that looks like a regular leaderboard ad gets collapsed down. Sometimes then there's site-specific overrides. So if there's a highly frequented website, they might add in specific rules just to adjust the content on that.
So you're saying that the easy list is this list that's frequently updated, so it would block things like doubleclick.com or whatever. Yeah. What if, let's say, a content producer started hosting their ads locally?
Yeah, so that can work, right? Technically speaking, what happens next is that the easy list community, when they spot the ads, will create a very specific rule for that website. And it's incredible. I mean, they can get on the case really, really quick, especially if they get into a bit of cat and mouse game with the publisher. They start watching out for it, which makes it a losing game. So the only thing a publisher can do is try and make the ads appear like they're coming from a URL, like a path on the web server that's indistinguishable from the path of other things in the web server, which the user does want, right? And you also have to start rotating them, right? Because you can't just make them look similar. They need to actually be unpredictable and similar.
An integral part of the site itself, pretty much.
Yeah.
Have companies tried to do that?
Well, we've looked at it way back in the early days. ClarityRay, another company in Tel Aviv that was recently acquired by Yahoo, I don't actually know how they did it. I think they might have been doing something very similar to that. So, you could imagine achieving something like this with a reverse proxy, right? That dynamically remaps short-lived arbitrary paths back to assets on a web server and ads on another server. Yeah. But from our point of view, you know, we figured out how you do that, but we decided it's not a good idea, you know. Let's not go to war with the users.
No, it sounds very technologically complex and potentially fragile anyway for websites that are significantly large.
Yeah. I think actually the main problem that's encountered by a website that tries to do this is that there isn't really a market out there of advertisers who are trying to treat users with respect, right? So even if you can do this, where do you get the ads from? And how do you get those ads onto your web server so that you can serve them? And there's a big technology pipeline that exists in the ad industry to basically get the right ad in front of the right person, you know, and it's not done on Apache, you know. So there's a technology challenge for a publisher who can do this. Yeah, you can make something that looks like an ad appear, but you can't get to the pipeline of ads that's out there or into the advertising exchanges with that approach.
Yeah, so they'd be tied to just presenting maybe promotional materials for their own stuff, but not targeted things for you because you recently looked at shoes.
Yeah, something like a direct sold sponsorship campaign.
So then how does PageFair get around ad blockers?
Well, the first thing we did when we looked at this was we thought, you know, is there a way to, you know, just put the ads back? And, you know, we outlined one way you could do it there. And then we came up with another way you could get around the CSS overrides, which basically has to do with obfuscating an ad and the DOM. And, you know, you and me and probably a lot of your listeners, you know, could invent different ways to do this kind of stuff. But it's important to say that the next thing that we identified for ourselves is that just putting ads back, you know, in front of the user that doesn't want to look at ads, like, isn't the solution, right? We've got to put good ads back, and we've got to do it in a way that's respectful and try and do it in a way that has, you know, in a way that involves the consensus of as many partners as possible. When we saw what AdBlock Plus was doing with the Acceptable Ads Initiative, they basically defined as the characteristics of a good ad exactly what we've written on the whiteboard here as what we would say is these are the only kinds of ads that we'll display. So we thought, well, maybe we'll go talk to those guys and see if we can do, negotiate something. And that's actually what we did. So right now today, we're showing ads to the users of the AdBlock Plus plugin, the leading AdBlock plugin, the biggest one. And we're doing it with their permission, and we're doing it in an extremely polite way. In fact, we've even put an ad blocker into our ad. So there's a close button on our ad. So if you don't like our ad, we're like, that's great. Turn it off on this website, deliberately.
So that's with one of the two major ad blocking tools. What about the other one?
We're not really doing anything with them yet, but you know, I hope to be able to demonstrate that what we're doing is a reasonable solution for everyone, that the users don't mind it. And those few who do have a very direct answer, which is just turn them off with our close button. And in the meantime, it actually sustains the websites that ad blockers like the most. So that's hopefully a win-win. So I hope to be able to build that case up and take it to them and just show the world, basically, this is the right way to do it. Don't block all ads equally, right? Because you're blocking the good with the bad. What kind of incentive system is that, right? Allow ads that people actually like to display by default and allow them to turn them off if it doesn't suit them personally.
But you mentioned that the easy list is a user-maintained list of effectively regular expressions that block content coming from particular places. Because you have a relationship with one of the ad blockers, what if you get on the easy list, though? Will that affect your...
We actually have a good relationship with EasyList as well. Every time we change something, we send them the rule to block us. Right? So, we're trying to really just acknowledge, you exist, and you exist for a reason, and we're not going to try to... you said I could curse, right? We're not going to try to fuck them, right?
No problem.
So, I think actually the last time we changed something in our domain name, we realized, oh, this would slip through there. And we sent them a mail saying, you'll need to update your rule for us because we're going to deploy this change. And they sent us a mail back saying it's the first time an ad company ever sent them a block rule for themselves. But so we're on that. So EasyList blocks us. And that's fine because with Adblock Plus, we're whitelisted. So those users who haven't turned off the acceptable advertising will see us, right? So the whitelist overrides the block list. That's the way that works.
So if I was using Adblock Plus or the Adblock tool, and I said I don't want to see the unobtrusive, you would be blocked too?
Yeah. Okay. So if you basically turn off that, we'll be blocked.
So you are largely dependent to some degree on the developers of the ad blocking plugins to put you on this whitelist and allow you through if the user so wants it.
Yeah, and we put ourselves in that position. Yeah. Right. We could have gone down the path like maybe Clarity Ray did. I don't really know exactly any inside story there, so I just know what I could observe from their website. But it looked like they went down the path of anti ad block technology.
Also, then they came in an arms race. They'll innovate. Someone else will innovate.
Yeah, but even more, you stand back and you're saying, like, this is DRM, It's like DRM with music and Napster and all that stuff. It wasn't the right answer, right? The right answer involves bringing the user along with the journey. And for us, that means the cooperation of Adblock Plus. So we actually want that dependency because working with them means that, we're doing right by the main Adblock plugin. Right, anything we come up with has got to be sustainable as a result of that. Right, so we're really glad to have their cooperation in that way. And with that, hopefully, we'll get to a place where we can turn around and show the world, hey, this is working. Now, anyone who doesn't come up to the table and get some of this is just being plain unreasonable.
All right, so that's how your tool fits with the blockers and with the lists. How does it fit into the hosting site?
Right, so the publisher website.
Yes.
It's a piece of JavaScript, right? It's just one JavaScript tag, right?
Cookie or like a tracker for an analytics tool.
So yeah, like an analytics tool. So the process from a publisher's point of view is the Google app, solve ad block, stop ad block or something like that. They find us, they sign up, they get a little unique JavaScript tracker. It's got a little site ID in there. And they drop that on their website. Right? Immediately, that starts gathering, basically doing ad block testing of users and sending it back to our aggregation system. So we end up tracking every page view on their website to measure ad blocker, not ad blocker. Right? So that allows them to basically audit their exposure. And then if they want to go forward, there's an extra step they can take, which is to take little divs, right? Which they come into our site and they define a few divs saying, I want to have a leaderboard, a skyscraper, like a medium rectangle, so the different ad formats that are there. And we give them a little div for each of those with a code. And they go back to their website and pop those into their DOM, wherever they want our ads to display. And that's it. So, from that point on, if someone's using Adblock Plus on that website and hasn't turned off acceptable advertising, then, we'll detect that and say, okay, let's go get a Pagefair ad and try and put something that's, nice and reasonable here into each of these units. So it's a really easy journey for the publisher. It works very well. We haven't even tried to optimize this, and we get a really high conversion rate right the way through to install.
And so you make it. It sounds like you make it very easy. Anyway, they get to find out how much ad blocking is going on before committing to using your ad system.
Yeah.
So then, on your back end, how does it work?
Right. So this is where that experience in Daemonware came in useful. So as we, got from small video games up to medium-sized video games and then Call of Duty and Guitar Hero and ended up with, something like 4,000 servers in 5 data centers. We learned how to make things scale. And, that's been useful in this company. The back end is all Python, right? So we're pretty much a Python shop. There's a Redis database, MySQL. It's all on Linux, on Amazon. Right. So basically, I think actually stats aggregation is it's one of those problems you have to solve every so often, right? And I've ended up having some strong opinions about it, and I think this architecture reflects that. Have you ever done any data warehousing or anything like that?
No. Right?
So a lot of companies, I think, when they're collecting events from clients, at scale, the default response is collect everything, log everything, store everything, and put it in a huge data warehouse and have these n-dimensional data cubes and some online reporting system. You can easily end up building a hugely expensive system, right? Because if you try to track every event and make every event queryable in multiple dimensions in real time, you know, you're talking about immense storage and processing resources. So this is a kind of practical thing, but I found that in nearly all cases, you can identify, you know, 90% of the queries you're going to want to run in advance. And then the remaining 10%, in 90% of those cases, you can live with the fact that you're saying, oh, I forgot about that one, and put it in and collect some data and get your answer, which leaves you only about 1% of cases where you're saying, drat, I wish I had a $2 million data warehouse. So we always went with the cheap option. The data goes into the system. It hits, I think it's a Twisted server. So Twisted is a Python asynchronous networking framework. So the network, basically the networking write up from the point that the event, the HTTP request from the JavaScript hits us, is fully asynchronous right the way through. There's no threaded servers or anything like that in the way that could get choked. So it hits Twisted. Basically, it goes into a pipeline where it gets counted, right? So it all boils down to counters, right? So we've got counters on websites in multiple dimensions and against time. So I think we do it at 5 minute granularity or something like that, and then roll it up. But you know, if you're trying to collect an awful lot of stats, you know, like what we collect is browser type, country, you know, website, hour, that kind of stuff, right? So just a relatively small number of dimensions. It still turns into a lot of data, but we're able to handle it at scale because we've decided everything's just a number and just needs to be added to the correct counter. And the challenge then is just making sure that request can get through the system front to back quickly without there being any big bottlenecks like an Apache server with a thread pool that could get swamped or something. You know, and it's good. So it's on Amazon. I think we can do about 3,000 requests per second per instance, and they're not the expensive instances.
And is that for statistics gathering or for serving of ads?
So that's I'm really thinking about statistics gathering there.
That's fine. Yeah.
Because that's actually most of the scale, because we gather statistics on non-ad blockers as well as ad blockers. So we're up to something like 6 billion requests per month now. There's a lot of websites using it, right? We see all of it. We have all of their traffic. But it's similar for the ads.
And then with your Amazon, do you scale it, let's say, different times of the day, week, event?
I think generally you can just provision this stuff. So we just basically have provisioned a number of servers and have made sure that it's very fast for us to provision more. We don't have any dynamic kind of elastic scaling stuff going on. I think the returns on that are relatively low in this kind of application. So if you're using it as actually like a compute cloud, you've occasionally got a really huge problem that you've got to go and crunch. You've got to fold some proteins or, you know, search for extraterrestrial intelligence or something. Then it's fine. Yeah, you want to have something that can dynamically scale out and scale back. I think another good use case is load testing, right? If you want to basically provision a compute cloud to load test a cluster, you know, that works pretty well on something like Amazon, you know, dynamically provisioning stuff out. But if you're running a service, you know, you're going to have a basic traffic level that's going to a sine wave during the day. In fact, in Daemonware and here, we see the same traffic pattern, and I'm sure most people do. It's a double humped sine wave. It's Europe waking up, then America waking up, then Europe going to sleep, then America going to sleep. Repeat every day. But basically, you know, the variance between the peak and the trough is not gigantic. You know, there's no point shutting down the servers at night or provisioning more at 6 p.m. So we just keep them there and make sure that we can respond fast to situations where, say, another giant website signs up with us.
So then how do you serve your ads?
Right, so the ad pipeline is a little bit more interesting, right? So from the browser's point of view, the page loads, we detect you're an ad blocker, We look in the page. Do we have any ad slots in the page? Okay, we do it. The JavaScript ad calls back to the page for a backend. The interesting thing about ads is that you want to try and make an intelligent choice about what ad to show where, right? Because, you know, it could be annoying otherwise or not make much money. So we're in a phase right now where we started off with a few different kinds of ads. And at the start, as we were trialing things, we'd have like one source of ads, like say product-related ads, tagged for a particular site that, for instance, was mainly reviewing tech gadgets, right? And then we'd have another kind of ad, like job ads for programmers, tagged to websites that were mainly about, you know, Windows Server system administration or whatever, right? That's where we started. But where we're moving to now is an advertising exchange model, where essentially there's a real-time auction happening on every single ad impression in our backend, right? This is it's a cool architecture. It's not like we invented it. There's ad exchanges out there. Online advertising is moving towards this. Right now, I think this year, something like 30 or 40% of the banner ads you'll see are actually served through this kind of model, through Google AdX, AppNexus, PubMatic, or a few of these other like real-time advertising exchanges. And basically, we're following the same thing, but just being careful about user privacy. So the ad call comes in, hits the exchange, right, which performs a real-time auction. That calls out asynchronously to multiple bidder systems, which can be internal to Pagefair or be in our partner companies. And we say, hey, we've got an impression. It's on this website. You know, it's a Firefox user from Kentucky. Okay? And that bidding system can make its own decision about whether or not it wants to respond to the bid request. And if so, what it wants to bid. Right? And everyone puts their bids in. And the auction resolves within 100 milliseconds, right? Bids have to be in, like the best bid wins, and it goes back. And then there's a bit more stuff, like you look at what ads have been historically performing well. If there's a bidder that obviously isn't doing any real data science, so they're making blind bids or stupid bids, you know, we basically cut that stuff out, right? Because you don't want to annoy users with, you know, someone who's just basically blasting money into the system and not seeing if users are responding. But ideally, when it's working well, it means the bidding systems can have all of their own analytics. So the bidding system might be running, say, job ads for programmers. Okay, and it's there and it's saying, okay, I've got a database, a catalog of job ads, say from your former company, Brian, right? Some jobs board or something. And it's saying, okay, I've got this user. What will I bid to put this job ad in front of that user? Right, and it's got to figure out it's what it thinks is probably a strong likelihood, maybe using some kind of Bayesian inference network or something, right? Of that user, given the time of day, the place the user signed in from, the browser the user is using, the site that they're on, the content of the site. Right, so nothing personally identifiable, but still a lot of strong signals about how geeky the user might be, right? And decide, yeah, I think there is say a 0.3% chance that the user will click on my ad, and I know that I'll be paid this if he does, so I'm going to bid this amount. Right? So it's pretty neat, but it all has to happen extremely fast. And that's how a lot of ads online are working now. So as you browse websites, the ads that you see, if you turned off Adblock, this is how a lot of that stuff is happening. It's real-time auctions processing billions, tens of billions of ad requests per day. And yeah, it's the same architecture we're going for.
So are you part of a bigger auctioning network, or is this an auctioning network of your own?
It's one that we're building. So, I mean, we're not there yet, right? We're building these bidding systems ourselves, and they're proxying it to partners who aren't quite there yet in terms of knowing they want to integrate with us. But the path we're on is to establish this, make it work, and then open up an API and say, anyone who wants to bid on our auctions can come here and do it. Here's the rules. And we designed those rules so that, you know, there's nothing in there that's going to annoy a user. Right? A lot of the existing auctions that are out there, real-time exchanges for advertising, they've got slightly weird incentives that I think are making the advertising quality go downhill. You know, it's all about getting the click. So they're all shouting over each other, being more noisy. that kind of thing. They're also leaking an awful lot of personal user information out into third-party companies that are reselling them at scale to each other, which is something that's too technical for most average internet users to understand, but everyone should be worried about. So we want to set it up expressly to have rules that means none of this can happen. So it'll be the exchange that survives basically the privacy disruption and the ad blocking disruption.
That's what I was just going to ask you next. I was going to ask you if you tracked any of the users across the sites that they're on.
No. So we track, I should qualify that because, we have one cookie, a page for a cookie, with a unique ID in it, right? And that's used for us just to count uniques so that we know how many people we're seeing in the network. But it's not used for anything else. It doesn't get stored on the server.
So then the content of the ad is tailored to the page as opposed to the user?
Yeah, it's contextual targeting, is what they call it. Not behavioral. That would be targeting to the user. I think, we're not there yet. I'd like to figure out a way for PageFair where we can get there and figure out how to do some targeting to the user in a way that isn't creepy. Right? That would be powerful. I mean, certainly advertisers would like it more, so advertisers could spend more money, so websites could make more money, and they could do better content. And I think if anyone's in a position to figure out how to do that without infringing user privacy, I think we'll be in a position to do it. But we haven't really figured out how yet, to be honest. I mean, where is the line? Retargeting is really creepy. You know, retargeting are these ads where you go to a website and then you see ads for that website for the rest of the month. They dropped a cookie on you, and someone's bidding on one of these exchanges every time you pop up, which is, 100 times a day on one of these exchanges. No one knows what's happening. Most users don't know that's happening, but they're creeped out by it. We don't want to be those guys. But, maybe there's some way to be respectful, like to say, you know what, this is a user who is, able to program. Maybe that's a flag that we could send through to advertisers to help them target an ad that wouldn't be intrusive on privacy. We don't know. We're going to be very, very careful about whatever we do in that direction, but, it's all about trying to find a line. We're just going to start on an ultra-respectful end of the spectrum and slowly inch up until it starts getting murky and stop.
So then you wouldn't go anywhere like with the EFF's Panopticlick, where you can fingerprint a browser, figure out their plugins, and infer from that their technological or other interests?
No, never.
Some advertisers going that way?
Yeah, so I've heard of two companies, I'm not sure I can recall their names now, but two companies that are out there selling basically fingerprinting services into the ad industry. And, one part of this is it gets around what's called the problem of cookie churn, which is people clearing cookies, right? So it's a cookie churn problem, right? So it solves that problem, according to these guys selling into the industry. The other thing it does is, they can get, so Panopticlick, for your listeners, a bunch of people might know it. If you don't, go to it. It's scary. Search for Panopticlick, and Google will autocorrect it to the URL, probably. It looks at your browser. It looks at what fonts you have installed, your screen resolution, everything you can pick up. It can side-channel the fonts out, other plugins that are installed through JavaScript. And it normally picks up something in the range of 20 to 30 unique bits of information, which actually allows them to uniquely identify most people who have ever visited the website. So if you go there now, you'll find they have probably uniquely tracked you to within the group of about 2 to 3 million people, purely on the basis of your browser configuration and what they could pick up from your HTTP request.
So I have actually just done that in two ways. One with JavaScript enabled, and I was unique amongst 4 million tested computers. When I turn off JavaScript using something like NoScript, I am possibly 1 in 600,000 computers. But I have done this test with a completely clean install of Linux Mint, and I was unique within hundreds of thousands using a Firefox browser. So it seems that there is a way around the whole cookie thing.
Yeah, well, you know, we also have to put this in perspective. You know, it's interesting to know that so much information is leaked by a browser. But from an advertiser's point of view, the most important thing, apart from a cookie, is an IP address. And you're not going to get around that, right? So in reality, if you take browser fingerprinting, you really start with the IP address. And then you only need about 4 bits of information beyond that to triangulate the device in that household, yeah. You know, that that you're trying to, say, show that ad for hotels in Berlin to, because you went to some Berlin tourist website last week.
So on that topic,
it gets freakier. I can tell you one more freaky thing, please. Right? These companies that are doing this, it's not just for solving the cookie churn problem, but it's for trying to identify that this user X on a mobile device is the same user as user Y at this work PC or this laptop that they have when they take on vacation, right? And you know, that's another value add that these companies say they're selling to these advertising companies that are trying to make more informed bids on advertising exchanges. And that's just statistics, right? That part of that is looking at your phone, right? If you've got a, you know, phones can leak out more information than a browser in many ways, right? If you've got an app on a phone, maybe, I actually don't know if the Facebook app would do this. Probably not. If they do, it'd be constrained within Facebook. There's a lot of advertising modules that are included in free apps that are out there, and they could do this. Those apps can see your GPS location potentially from your phone, as well as how accurate that your phone thinks that GPS location is. I can see your current IP address with your Wi-Fi and make the two correspond with each other, right? So they have more information about you there. So now that phone, as it goes on the road with its device ID, can now be correlated back to that home, right? And as they could see that phone move around the world or whatever, they have a movement pattern that can be analyzed to figure out, well, what one of those places is probably the person's workplace. Right. You can do a lot.
Yeah, yeah. As well, of course, they have probably your Gmail email address, your contacts list, so who you know, depending on what permissions they've requested. Most people pay no attention to what's asked for.
These companies are called data management platforms, DMPs. It's a big section of the ad industry that you do not see. These companies exist to, the euphemism in this case, I think, is enrich data.
Or layer
of value on top of cookies, right? But they correlate different kinds of tracking. They buy databases of cookies off each other. They sync these cookies. They interface with exchanges. They pull all the data in and they correlate it. And then they sell this more unified picture of the user back to advertisers who bid on the exchanges. These companies see you all over the web because they're integrated with the exchanges. And as you visit a website that's got an ad service running on it that's connected to one of the advertising exchanges that's connected to the DMPs, there's an opportunity for the DMP, data management platform company, to send a tracking pixel, like it was, you know, a one-by-one clear GIF, right, all the way down to the browser and get that cookie back, right? And they can do that basically on every website that's hooked into the real-time bidding ecosystem. So you have these companies that you don't know exists, you have no relationship with, it's not in there in your URL bar or your address bar, and you don't know it's on the website. And, you know, even if you looked at the source code, you mightn't be able to tell, but it's there able to see what websites you're visiting, and it's pulling all this information together into a database that it's reselling about you. And there are lots of this is happening everywhere. That's scary. And it's not what Pagefair is ever going to be about.
One thing about Pagefair, obviously there's a amount of geekiness. I used NoScript plugin for Firefox to block JavaScript. Because if you go to a typical website, there could be 10, 15 different JavaScript sources. Yeah. And I'll usually only allow the primary one and block everything else. When I end up on a site that's using Pagefair, will there be JavaScript from you? And what happens if I have NoScript blocking Pagefair?
Yeah, well then Pagefair won't run. Yeah, we're JavaScript, we're in the site. If you're using NoScript, I think that's totally fine. I think you're definitely in that category of people.
I've been using NoScript for years.
A very hardcore minority of even ad blockers who very much don't want to have their have the web served to them in any other way than what they wanted. So yeah, we don't run, and that's not a lost opportunity. I think commercially either. I don't think you're someone we'd want to offend by putting an ad in front of.
No, I suppose one way around it would be to host your JavaScript on the client, but that's significantly changed your infrastructure and architecture.
Yeah. Let's see. All right, so you're talking about you're using NoScript, but okay, right. You're
I'll allow it for the site I'm visiting, yeah. Let's say news.com or something. Or,
yeah.
But I won't allow it for anything that's on, else that's on that site.
Mm, yeah. Well, it would be possible, basically, to get all the JavaScript just on, into the web page.
Yeah.
I think I think we might download another loader in one case or another. But yeah, we could, but I mean, why would you want to?
Yeah, yeah. Again, you're only going to annoy a person who's doing their best to not be annoyed.
Mm. But how many users does NoScript have these days?
I don't know. I'd have to look. I haven't checked for a while.
Do you find the web is actually usable?
In what sense?
I mean, websites are designed to be dynamic.
Oh, I'll allow. So if I'm using Stack Exchange or I'm using Amazon, I will allow it for those particular sites.
Yeah.
I'll allow it for their, you know, Amazon images. I'll allow it for the static ones. But, you know, it remembers my preferences. But I'll never allow it for a company I know is an advertising company, or a company that I have absolutely no interest in, sort of,
yeah,
on BBC. Why am I going to allow DoubleClick? I don't need to. BBC, I allow, so videos will play.
But there's so many third-party widgets in websites now. I mean, you create a website, you tend to depend on the actual ecosystem of like web services that are out there to compose large sections of the website. Maybe it's embedding a YouTube player or Facebook likes or whatever. There's an increasing amount of functionality that's actually third-party stuff embedded in the web page. It's not about advertising or tracking, yep, even though it technically could. But you could solve that with disconnect and ad block. And, you know, they would block everything you need to be worried about, but third-party JavaScript would still run unless they got blocked specifically because they're trying to track you or show you an ad.
So it sounds like one of the big causes of ad blocking becoming very popular was YouTube. Are you looking at video solutions or replacements for the likes of YouTube?
No, we don't. We don't have any real desire right now to try and put video ads back. Like, it looks like video ads are pretty much what people are installing Adblock to get rid of. So it's not really part of our mission to put ads back that people don't want.
It seems like a strange, yeah, an unfortunate circumstance for Google to have killed their ad, not killed it, but significantly damaged their ad industry by putting ads on their video tool, and now the popularity of ad blockers is hurting everything that they do.
Yeah, it's true. If it wasn't Google, it would be someone else, though. You know, Google just happens to own YouTube.
Yeah.
Right? YouTube has to have a business model, and the obvious one is advertising, and it pays very well. Maybe the problem is that, you know, maybe as they focus on this more and more over the next couple of years, they might improve the advertising experience a bit. That's not to say that ad blockers will turn off ad block, but new ones might stop, like, adopting it. Like, when you use YouTube, things like seeing the same ad too many times, right, that's extremely frustrating. Ads you can't skip drive people insane, right? In our survey that we did, which your visitors can all look up, which is Adblock Goes Mainstream.
I'll put a link at the bottom of the post.
Sure. So we asked people's attitudes, ad blockers' attitudes to different kinds of ads. We did a survey across US internet users. By the way, 27% of people we asked in the US said that they used Adblock. I don't believe that's true. I think that's too high. But at the very least, it means 27% of people in the US aspire to use Adblock. But it was a pretty insane number. But when we asked them about their attitudes to particular kinds of ads, there's a really vast difference between skippable pre-roll, right, and non-skippable forms of ads, right? So there was basically a scale, you know, and one end was completely unacceptable. For skippable pre-roll, 40%, 39% of ad blockers said skippable pre-roll is completely unacceptable. Which kind of means, you know, that 61% of people thought it was somewhat acceptable. And I thought that was actually surprisingly high. But non-skippable pre-roll, which YouTube is venturing into, that was 73% of users said totally unacceptable. And so there's a stark difference there, right? 39 versus 73%. So I think the skippability of it is crucial.
So it sounds like it was sort of greed that has brought this about, the growth of the ad blockers. Because one of the companies I worked at, we used to limit the number of ads we'd show to 3 a day for a given user. That was it. You know, whether it was interstitial or large banner, they wouldn't be hammered with more than 3. And those 3 might be spread out. It wouldn't be show a page interstitial, show another page interstitial. It would be over a few hours.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, I got to tell you, Brian, interstitial is not very popular either. I'm just reading this.
I'm sure. I didn't like them because they were too like a real page. And I think that used to annoy the users as well. It looked like part of the form for the sign-up, but it happened to be, I want to get information from some third party. Oh, damn it. I've just submitted my username, email, home address to some advertiser. I didn't like them.
It's confusing. It actually breaks the user interface. I mean, we all care about our user interface. We invest heavily in getting users to our websites. We care about the user interface. And then we go in and inject a bunch of interstitial ads. I mean, it makes no sense. The results of the survey was 71% of people, again, for interstitial said completely unacceptable. So it was actually one of the
very high,
most hated kinds of ads. I'm actually always quite surprised by them because even if you go to Forbes, Forbes has an interstitial ad. Before you get to any content, they run an interstitial. I think it's crazy. I mean, they should be focused on their own brand and not damaging it like that and trying to maintain a relationship with their end users. And interstitials, I think, are, yeah, they intrude on the content. You could not intrude on the content more than actually not serving the content and serving an ad instead, right? But I think what you said there was very interesting, that sometimes you actually wouldn't show an ad. You know, we've been thinking about that. I think there's an opportunity to do something radically different here. And we were thinking, well, maybe it's more valuable for all concerned with PageFair if we don't show an ad all the time. Sometimes you say, you know what? Cooling period. This user's seen enough. Right? Yeah. Or, you know what? We have an ad to run here, but our confidence isn't high enough that this ad is relevant. Right? So let's not show an ad in this instance. Right? So to have a bar where you're saying, we run our auction, we get bids in, we have ads, we look at it and say, crap, 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 none of those are running in this case. Right? It hasn't passed the minimum threshold of relevancy. And that means there might be a lot of cases where we don't show ads. But in the cases where we do show ads, they'll actually be seen, right, and be more relevant. So we're not there yet, but, you know, that's the kind of thinking we're trying to put into it.
So if ad blockers, it seems they are the future, the growth rate is quite high. There is an alternative for, let's say, text you're reading on a site, you want to, a company like yours will present a very simple ad. But what about the likes of YouTube as ad blockers become more prominent? What are they going to do?
I think they're in a bit of a cat and mouse game with the EasyList community, you know, changing it up a little bit, and then EasyList responds in 2 hours.
Is it that? It's that quick, 2 hours? Cause I haven't seen an ad on YouTube in quite some time.
Yeah. So with a big site like that, you know, they can watch out for changes. I don't know. I got to say, with video, the dynamics are a little bit different, right? With the web, just web content, the general attitude out there is that it's free because it has been free for a long time. And it's, you know, before the web, you used to have to pay for your magazines and your newspapers, even if they were still full of ads, right? With the web, suddenly you couldn't even pay anymore, right? Or you didn't have to pay anymore. And everyone just assumes that text is free, right? It's not the best situation for the world, but it's where we are. I don't think we're there with video yet. So I think the user attitude towards whether or not, you know, video is free or not is still up to be defined, or yet to be defined, right? I'm not really talking necessarily about maybe the listeners to this podcast who, you know, are very technically sophisticated. So we know about things like BitTorrent and so on, right? I'm talking about like the average internet user out there, right? Who isn't like a geek anymore. It's just an average person. How does that person look at video online? And I think, you know, I think that can be redefined to say, you know, actually video online costs money and you don't get to look at it without ads. Or if you do want to look at it without ads, you have to pay or something like that. And I think all the TV stations in the world are very worried about this right now because they're going digital and they're suffering from ad blocking. And they're like, holy cow, what's this? This didn't used to exist. Or I suppose maybe for them it's like TiVo, right? Yeah, but maybe over the next few years, there'll be a battle to try to define consensus around how this content gets paid for, right? And I think we'll see more ad block walls. For one, there's already TV stations out there doing that kind of stuff. Over here in Europe, in the UK, ITV and 4OD have adblock walls up. You can't watch the stuff with adblock on. And, you know, I kind of get them. They're like, yeah, that's original content. They're the TV stations that made it, you know. They're like, yeah, you know, no one gets to, you know, download, you know, a gigabyte of data off us from the show that we just spent, you know, 10 million making for free. Right. So like if I was like either of those TV stations, I would probably feel pretty entitled to say, no, you don't get to watch this without the ads on our server. On the other hand, you know, it might be a little short sighted because they might just be encouraging people to go to less legitimate sources to get the content. But, you know, I think it's a battle that's yet to be played out. And hopefully there's a constructive way to do it. Like maybe giving people the option to subscribe to something or pay for it, or maybe just like move on to Netflix or some other kind of consumption channel where, you know, there's a fair model where the content producers can be basically paid to continue to produce content.
Something I ask all my guests for are a few books that have been very helpful to them in their career. We don't always talk about it, but you have a few that you want to mention.
Oh, definitely. This is kind of my list that I have for people who I'm hiring, you know, students or graduates that are coming into the company. And I want to shake them in the image of a professional I want to work with. And I guess some of it is just from a lucky or hard-earned experience. Right, so I mentioned The Innovator's Dilemma by Clay Christensen before. I think for any entrepreneur and for most technologists, it's a really well worth read, a very tough book. At a minimum, after reading it, you won't misuse the phrase disruptive anymore. Right?
It's used quite a lot by everyone, I've noticed.
It's turning into like some of that bullshit jargon that plagues us in this industry. But it actually has a meaning that was defined by that book, and it's a specific meaning that doesn't correlate to what most people use it as. But the book for me was like, just learning how to think through and plot about what's going to happen next with technologies, right? Or where you want to be when that happens, or how you can take advantage of things. Or if you have an idea for something, some invention, some website, some app, basically how to play it. What's the playbook for taking this to market and actually making an impact? And besides that, it was fascinating. Apart from some pretty dense kind of thinking around a bunch of like the more analytical stuff in the book. It was fascinating just to see basically a review of the disruptive cycles that the storage industry, the digital storage industry, went through from the 60s right way up to the mid-90s when the book was written, right? So you're talking about, I forget, like the huge kind of big platter hard drives that looked like washing machines all the way through to SD drives, right? And basically where each of those technologies found its initial market and then ultimately got good enough to take the entire market from the previous generation of companies, all of whom always reacted exactly the same way to this newcomer to the market, right? Which was to say, that'll never take off, right? It's just totally predictable and everyone falls into the same trap. And there's a way you can understand this. So The Innovator's Dilemma. But to rewind way back, there's some books that have, I think, just given me a number of professional superpowers or maybe life superpowers. And you know, sometimes, you know, sometimes just little practical things can help an awful lot. I think in our industry, communication is actually one of the biggest, you know, skills, most important skills you can develop, right? You can be program all you like, but no matter how good a programmer you are personally, you're not going to get a huge or very important project done single-handedly, right? And in any large project, the challenge becomes less the code and the algorithms and more the architecture, which becomes a communal thing that you have to own, right? So even as programmers, right, goes against our stereotype, like, you know, all those, you know, our, all those other kind of like people in other industries have about us. But even as programmers, communication is incredibly powerful. And also just in life, we need to write a lot, and no one can write well. That really annoys me. There's a simple answer. It's a book called The Elements of Style. It's by Strunk and White. I think it's, let me Google it here. It's an old book, right? It goes all the way back to, I think, 1912 or something like that. Oh, 1920, right? And it's basically a very short manual of style. You can get it for free online because it's well out of copyright. And it just tells you how to write cleanly, clearly, and tersely. And it's terrific. I read that when I was doing my undergrad thesis. A lecturer had advised me to write it. I read it, and then I wrote my thesis, and I got the highest score to date at that point in my course, as I understand it, for that dissertation. And it was just simply a question of like just understanding that grammar is the syntax of communication, and communication is how we think communally, and it should be respected. And now that I've read that book, I am intolerant of people who don't know where the comma goes, who don't understand the difference between it's and its, or that and which, and so on, right? These things matter. It's how we communicate, right? So The Elements of Style, it's like 80 pages long. Do it. Your life will be better, and everyone will appreciate it. Next one. In DemonWare, I got swamped when we got really busy, and suddenly we were doing 50 video games at the same time with a tiny staff. And I was on the road constantly and was receiving about 900 emails a day. And about 200 of those were from humans, but required answers. I was not managing my affairs very well. And our sales guy, who was terrific, basically rescued me from the situation. And on one of our sales trips, basically up and down North America, one of these three-week trips, when we went everywhere together, he started indoctrinating me into GTD, right? Getting things done, right? It's a little bit cultish. There's nothing in the book that seems cultish, right? Nothing like that. It's not like fuzzy-wuzzy or anything like that. It's a simple, practical method for handling an inbox and a calendar and a to-do list, right? That the author, David Allen, who's, I suppose, a kind of executive coach, like from pre-digital, right? Because a lot of the book is not actually concerned with email, but more with letters and so on. You just learn this. This is how you handle your inbound communications, your calendaring, and your to-do list in a way that allows you to make sure that you're on top of your own work. And when you go home in the evening, know that there's nothing you forgot, and you can actually relax and put it down and have a comfortable evening thinking about other things, you know, a good night's sleep, and come into work and know where things stand and pick it up again, right? It's a simple, simple set of rules for a workflow, basically, for handling this stuff. And the thing is that it's so effective that everyone who's read it becomes a kind of GTD head and talks about it and call as GTD and starts spreading it to other people like it was some kind of new religion. Yeah, if you read it, you know, you'll find you do the same thing. And when you encounter other people who do GTD, you'll be high-fiving and shit like that.
Secret right? Handshake and all that.
Yeah. But what it is, basically, it's a flowchart, right? It's a workflow, and you can just apply it to emails, your calendar, and a to-do list. You can do it much more easily today than you could when this book was presumably written, right? Because you're probably just doing it with Gmail or something. But it's great. Right, it's about inbox zero. Right, it's about basically you don't have an inbox cluttered full of stuff that you don't actually have to do anything with. Right, if something comes in, you do it because it's you can do it faster than you can figure out anything, then you can calendar it. If it will take a long time, you calendar it. You go and say, I'm going to do that on Friday between 2 and 3, and you block it out and assign it. You get rid of the message in, from your inbox, or you delegate it because it's not for you, and you put something in your to-do list to say, I'm at the bottom in a special ticklers list. I'm owed something back from this person. I just delegated this thing to, right? And you go through your communications top to bottom, and your to-do list top to bottom, and you only have one list. Make sure you only have one to-do list. I basically outlined the whole thing. When you read probably the first half of the book, you'll get a bunch of examples, and suddenly you'll just be relaxed. And when I read that, things just turned around for me. I mean, this is the kind of semi-religious conversion part of it. I became a happier person because when I went home in the evenings, I went home saying, I'm done with work. I'm not being terrorized by one mental process constantly refreshing a to-do list of things that I'm trying not to forget, right? And another mental process trying to think about all the things that I forgot to do and wondering what panicked emails I'm going to get in the middle of the night when something I forgot about blows up, right? All of that stress just went away. And ever since, I've been very responsive on my emails, totally on top of all of my tasks, and generally a lot more chilled out, and probably more productive than anything else, and enjoy, I think, a pretty good professional reputation for being, you know, a good person to work with, right? So getting things done. It's a bit cheesy. It's not as self-helpy as it sounds, but it's good. Okay, one more?
Sure.
Okay, last one. This is more contemporary, but it blew me away, and I've been trying to get everyone to read it. So a lot of people will have because it's been a bestseller recently. Thinking Fast and Slow, Daniel Kahneman, right? So that's a brilliant book, right? That's basically psychology and understanding how your own mind works and where your biases are kicking in and where when they're going to kick in so that you know it's about to happen to you and you might be able to do something about it, right? So basically it's a model of basically how, you know, people think, right? And when you fall back to your general pattern recognition and experience, which is an appropriate thing to do in most cases, right? Especially when you have experience, knowing when you should allow yourself to use it. And then in other cases where you're saying, okay, this is time to actually engage some cognitive kind of analytical thinking. Right? And there's two modes of thinking and different situations will provoke you into responding in one way or another. And sometimes it's dysfunctional. Right? And it's also just a really fun book. And basically this is the guy who defined this whole field of, let's see, what's it actually called? Is it behavioral psychology? Yeah, something like that. About this entire field of psychology. So Daniel Kahneman and his former academic partner who passed away, I think, a good few years ago, basically from, I think, from the 60s forward, defined this entire field, right? I think they won a Nobel Prize and stuff, right? And this is Kahneman's basically roundup book of his entire career and the entire field written from his voice, the person who essentially defined it in an incredibly engaging and insightful and relevant way, right? It's a fun book to read, incredibly useful. And once again, it's one of those books you read and then it's just a touch point. Again, when you're just working, doing stuff, talking to people, you're saying, aha, I'm going to use that thing from this book now and understand that this person's responding in this way, which is due to this bias, and the right thing to do isn't just to like argue against the person, or maybe you catch it in yourself and you realize, oh, hang on, I'm being irrational here in a way that maybe you mightn't have realized before, right? Which is very powerful. So there you go, four life-changing books.
One of the things you mentioned just about clear writing and communication, I remember some years back when you were still in Demonware, you were saying that you'd go to trade shows and the like, and there'd be a certain amount of schmoozing, but the real deals were done when you were outside smoking with the other smokers.
Yeah. So I think several times gave up smoking during Demonware, only to pick it up again at conferences because I'd be trying to, you know, socialize or something, and I'd go, okay, I'll just buy a pack of cigarettes and hang out in the smoking area, which is where everyone mixes from every field. It cuts across everything. Thankfully, I managed to give up properly several years later. But I think, you know, actually, one thing we used a lot in Demonware was the whole Irish gift of the gab kind of thing. And, you know, take the alcoholic Irish image and use it to throw fun parties and stuff. We really played up to that stereotype, and it really worked. Because people also, I think, expect Irish people to be a bit more gregarious and therefore open up a little bit faster around Irish guys than, you know, maybe someone else. So it's a fun thing to do. But yeah, you know, for me, there was a real, I was a shy kid. When I went to college, I was shy, you know. And I took a lot of deliberate steps to try to force myself out of my shell by just doing scary things like running for student election and stuff like that. Just stuff I was not ready for, but I knew it would change me. And it eventually worked. And it's just because I realized at some point it's, you know, you got to work with people. This is where great things happen. It's with other people. And that's all about communication.
Yeah, I've noticed that. I get the impression that obviously there is a degree where technology comes in. It has to be able to do what it's supposed to do. It has to be cost effective. But when it comes down to a choice between two competitors, you go with the person you feel more comfortable with because you have a relationship. And you know that if it goes wrong, you'll be able to ring up that person you know and say, hey, Sean, you know, your company's not quite delivering. Please sort it out for me. As opposed to ringing up the company that you don't have any contact in.
Yeah, definitely. It's about trust. It's always about trust and feeling like you have a relationship that goes beyond a contract. You know, so when you're on a call with someone, actually having a joke, you know, at the start, they're talking about the weather stuff, the tone of voice, the body language. It's all about trying to figure out, do you have a communication channel that goes beyond the more robotic kind of, you know, we will give you an API and, you know, we will charge you $599 per month for a service. You know, it's about, hey, you know, you can call me up, I'm a human. It's like, oh, cool. Yeah, I hope that, like, you know, you got a chance to use that motorbike you bought that you told me about last month, that kind of stuff, right? It's gold. And another thing we did and we still do a lot is, especially because we're starting these businesses from Ireland, and we don't tend to stay in Ireland. You know, engineering stays here, but I do my sales across the US. But we're very, very keen on demonstrating that we get on planes fast. And in Demonware, it was interesting because we ran the company from Ireland nearly exclusively for the first 3 years. But we traveled to our customers more than our US competitors did, right? Because I suppose we were overcompensating. But it was a similar thing. We were trying to show that we're humans, we'll come to you, we're personable, you know, we can have a relationship. If you've got a problem, we're going to be there for you right the way through it until it's solved. And just demonstrating that kind of, commitment is where the business was made.
And are you still doing that with PageFair?
Yeah, yeah. I like to say on every single call we do with, like, we've got, 2,000 websites signed up and 1,100 using us. So we don't visit them all. In fact, we don't talk to them all. Mainly they self-serve. But especially the bigger guys who need help or have an organization they need to sell through, need more information, we get in a call very, very fast. And I always try and like emphasize in that first call, like, if you've got any problems, let us know. We'll be on a plane. And try to let know what my calendar is anyway so that I can meet them personally as soon as possible.
Sean Blanchfield, superpowered professional. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian. It's a pleasure.
The opening music, as always, is The Return by Nisi 23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was Moonlight Reprise by Kai Angel from the album Irzin's Tale.